Chapter 35. I felt a little uncomfortable about the cripplings and arsons this person had been entertaining himself with, for I could not help feeling remotely accessory to them. But these thoughts were quickly banished, for the regular editor walked in. I thought to myself, now if you had gone to Egypt as I recommended you to, I might have had a chance to get my hand in, but you wouldn't do it, and here you are. I sort of expected you. The editor was looking sad, and perplexed and dejected. He surveyed the wreck which that old rioter and those two young farmers had made, and then said, "This is a sad business, a very sad business. There is the mucilage bottle broken, and 6 panes of glass, and a spittoon, and 2 candlesticks. But that is not the worst. The reputation of the paper is injured and permanently, I fear. True, there never was such a call for the paper before, and it never sold such a large edition or soared to such celebrity. But does one want to be famous for lunacy, and prosper upon the infirmities of his mind? My friend, as I am an honest man, the street out here is full of people, and others are roosting on the fences, waiting to get a glimpse of you, because they think you are crazy. And well they might, after reading your editorials. They are a disgrace to journalism. Why, what put it into your head that you could edit a paper of this nature? You do not seem to know the first rudiments of agriculture. You speak of a furrow and a harrow as being the same thing. You talk of the molting season for cows, and you recommend the domestication of the polecat on account of its playfulness and its excellence as a ratter. Your remark that clams will lie quiet if music be played to them was superfluous, entirely superfluous. Nothing disturbs clams. Clams always lie quiet. Clams care nothing whatever about music. Ah, heavens and earth, friend. If you had made the acquiring of ignorance the study of your life, you could not have graduated with higher honor than you could today. I never saw anything like it. Your observation that the horse chestnut as an article of commerce is steadily gaining in favor is simply calculated to destroy this journal. I want you to throw up your situation and go. I want no more holiday. I could not enjoy it if I had it. Certainly not with you in my chair. I would always stand in dread of what you might be going to recommend next. It makes me lose all patience every time I think of your discussing oyster beds under the head of landscape gardening. ... I want you to go. Nothing on earth could persuade me to take another holiday. Oh, why didn't you tell me you didn't know anything about agriculture? Tell you, you cornstalk, you cabbage, you son of a cauliflower? It's the first time I ever heard such an unfeeling remark. I tell you I have been in the editorial business going on 14 years, and it is the first time I ever heard of a man's having to know anything in order to edit a newspaper. You turnip. Who write the dramatic critiques for the second-rate papers? Why, a parcel of promoted shoemakers and apprentice apothecaries, who know just as much about good acting as I do about good farming and no more. Who review the books? People who never wrote one. Who do up the heavy letters on finance? Parties who have had the largest opportunities for knowing nothing about it. Who criticize the Indian campaigns? Gentlemen who do not know a war whoop from a wigwam, and who never have had to run a foot race with a tomahawk, or pluck arrows out of the several members of their families, to build the evening campfire with. Who write the temperance appeals, and clamor about the flowing bowl. Folks who will never draw another sober breath till they do it in the grave. Who edit the agricultural papers, you yam. Men, as a general thing, who fail in the poetry line, yellow-colored novel line, sensation, drama line, city editor line, and finally fall back on agriculture as a temporary reprieve from the poorhouse. You try to tell me anything about the newspaper business. Sir, I have been through it from Alpha to Omaha, and I tell you that the less a man knows the bigger the noise he makes, and the higher the salary he commands. Heaven knows if I had but been ignorant instead of cultivated, and impudent instead of diffident, I could have made a name for myself in this cold, selfish world. I take my leave, sir. Since I have been treated as you have treated me, I am perfectly willing to go. But I have done my duty. I have fulfilled my contract as far as I was permitted to do it. I said I could make your paper of interest to all classes, and I have. I said I could run your circulation up to 20,000 copies, and if I had had 2 more weeks I'd have done it. And I'd have given you the best class of readers, that ever an agricultural paper had, not a farmer in it, nor a solitary individual who could tell a watermelon tree from a peach vine to save his life. You are the loser by this rupture, not me, pie plant. Adios. I then left. The petrified man, now, to show how really hard it is to foist a moral, or a truth upon an unsuspecting public through a burlesque without entirely and absurdly missing one's mark, I will here set down 2 experiences of my own in this thing. In the fall of 1862, in Nevada and California, the people got to running wild about extraordinary petrifactions and other natural marvels. One could scarcely pick up a paper without finding, in it 1 or 2 glorified discoveries of this kind. The mania was becoming a little ridiculous. I was a brand new local editor in Virginia City, and I felt called upon to destroy this growing evil. We all have our benignant, fatherly moods at one time or another, I suppose. I chose to kill the petrifaction mania with a delicate, a very delicate satire. But maybe it was altogether too delicate, for nobody ever perceived the satire part of it at all. I put my scheme in the shape of the discovery of a remarkably petrified man. I had had a temporary falling out with Mr. the new coroner and justice of the peace of Humboldt, and thought I might as well touch him up a little at the same time, and make him ridiculous, and thus combine pleasure with business. So I told, in patient, belief-compelling detail, all about the finding of a petrified man at Gravelly Ford, exactly 120 miles, over a breakneck mountain trail from where lived, how all the savants of the immediate neighborhood had been to examine it. It was notorious that there was not a living creature within 50 miles of there, except a few starving Indians, some crippled grasshoppers, and 4 or 5 buzzards out of meat, and too feeble to get away. How those savants all pronounced the petrified man to have been in a state of complete petrifaction for over 10 generations, and then, with a seriousness that I ought to have been ashamed to assume, I stated that, as soon as Mr. heard the news he summoned a jury, mounted his mule, and posted off, with noble reverence for official duty, on that awful 5 days journey, through alkali, sagebrush, peril of body, and imminent starvation, to hold an inquest on this man, that had been dead, and turned to everlasting stone for more than 300 years. And then, my hand being in, so to speak, I went on, with the same unflinching gravity, to state that the jury returned a verdict that deceased came to his death from protracted exposure. This only moved me to higher flights of imagination, and I said that the jury, with that charity so characteristic of pioneers, then dug a grave, and were about to give the petrified man Christian burial, when they found that for ages a limestone sediment had been trickling down the face of the stone against which he was sitting, and this stuff had run under him, and cemented him fast to the ed rock, that the jury, they were all silver-miners, canvassed the difficulty a moment, and then got out their powder and fuse, and proceeded to drill a hole under him, in order to blast him from his position, when Mr., with that delicacy so characteristic of him, forbade them, observing that it would be little less than sacrilege to do such a thing. From beginning to end the petrified man squib was a string of roaring absurdities, albeit they were told with an unfair pretense of truth, that even imposed upon me to some extent, and I was in some danger of believing in my own fraud. But I really had no desire to deceive anybody, and no expectation of doing it. I depended on the way the petrified man was sitting to explain to the public that he was a swindle. Yet I purposely mixed that up with other things, hoping to make it obscure, and I did. I would describe the position of one foot, and then say his right thumb was against the side of his nose, then talk about his other foot, and presently come back, and say the fingers of his right hand were spread apart, then talk about the back of his head a little, and return and say the left thumb was hooked into the right little finger, then ramble off about something else, and by drift back again, and remark that the fingers of the left hand were spread like those of the right. But I was too ingenious. I mixed it up rather too much. And so all that description of the attitude, as a key to the humbuggery of the article, was entirely lost, for nobody but me ever discovered and comprehended the peculiar and suggestive position of the petrified man's hands. As a satire on the petrifaction mania, or anything else, my petrified man was a disheartening failure, for everybody received him in innocent good faith, and I was stunned to see the creature I had begotten to pull down the wonder business with, and bring derision upon it, calmly exalted to the grand chief place in the list of the genuine marvels our Nevada had produced. I was so disappointed at the curious miscarriage of my scheme, that at first I was angry, and did not like to think about it. But by and by, when the exchanges began to come in with the petrified man copied and guilelessly glorified, I began to feel a soothing secret satisfaction. And as my gentleman's field of travels broadened, and by the exchanges I saw that he steadily and implacably penetrated territory after territory, state after state, and land after land, till he swept the great globe, and culminated in sublime and unimpeached legitimacy in the August London Lancet, my cup was full, and I said I was glad I had done it. I think that for about 11 months, as nearly as I can remember, Mr. S. Daily mailbag continued to be swollen by the addition of half a bushel of newspapers hailing from many climes with the petrified man in them, marked around with a prominent belt of ink. I sent them to him. I did it for spite, not for fun. He used to shovel them into his backyard and curse. And every day during all those months the miners, his constituents, for miners never quit joking a person when they get started, would call on him, and ask if he could tell them where they could get hold of a paper with the petrified man in it. He could have accommodated a continent with them. I hated Dash in those days, and these things pacified me and pleased me. I could not have gotten more real comfort out of him without killing him. My bloody massacre, the other burlesque I have referred to, was my fine satire upon the financial expedience of hooking dividends, a thing which became shamefully frequent on the Pacific coast for a while. Once more, in my self-complacent simplicity, I felt that the time had arrived for me to rise up and be a reformer. I put this reformatory satire in the shape of a fearful assessor at Empire City. The San Francisco papers were making a great outcry about the iniquity of the Daney Silver Mining Company, whose directors had declared a hooked or false dividend, for the purpose of increasing the value of their stock, so that they could sell out at a comfortable figure, and then scramble from under the tumbling concern. And while abusing the Daney, those papers did not forget to urge the public to get rid of all their silver stocks and invest in sound and safe San Francisco stocks, such as the Spring Valley Water Company, etc. But right at this unfortunate juncture, behold, the Spring Valley cooked a dividend too. And so, under the insidious mask of an invented Looty massacre, I stole upon the public unawares with my scathing satire upon the dividend cooking system. In about half a column of imaginary human carnage, I told how a citizen hard murdered his wife and 9 children, and then committed suicide. And I said slyly, at the bottom, that the sudden madness of which this melancholy massacre was the result had been brought about by his having allowed himself to be persuaded by the California papers to sell his sound and lucrative Nevada silver stocks, and buy into Spring Valley just in time to get cooked along with that company's fancy dividend, and sink every cent he had in the world. Ah, it was a deep, deep satire, and most ingeniously contrived. But I made the horrible detail so carefully and conscientiously interesting, that the public devoured them greedily, and wholly overlooked the following distinctly stated facts, to wit. The murderer was perfectly well known to every creature in the land as a bachelor, and consequently he could not murder his wife and 9 children. He murdered them in his splendid dressed stone mansion just in the edge of the great pine forest between Empire City and Dutch Nick's, when even the very pickled oysters that came on our tables knew that there was not a dressed stone mansion in all Nevada territory. Also that, so far from there being a great pine forest between Empire City and Dutch Nick's, there wasn't a solitary tree within 15 miles of either place. And, finally, it was patent and notorious that Empire City and Dutch Nick's were one and the same place, and contained only 6 houses anyhow, and consequently there could be no forest between them. And on top of all these absurdities I stated, that this diabolical murderer, after inflicting a wound upon himself, that the reader ought to have seen would kill an elephant in the twinkling of an eye, jumped on his horse and rode 4 miles, waving his wife's reeking scalp in the air, and thus performing entered Carson City with tremendous eclat, and dropped dead in front of the chief saloon, the envy and admiration of all beholders. Well, in all my life I never saw anything like the sensation that little satire created. It was the talk of the town, it was the talk of the territory. Most of the citizens dropped gently into it at breakfast, and they never finished their meal. There was something about those minutely faithful details that was a sufficing substitute for food. Few people that were able to read took food that morning. Dan was my reportorial associate, took our seats on either side of our customary table in the Eagle restaurant, and, as I unfolded the shred they used to call a napkin in that establishment, I saw at the next table 2 stalwart innocents with that sort of vegetable dandruff sprinkled about their clothing which was the sign and evidence that they were in from the truckee with a load of hay. The one facing me had the morning paper folded to a long, narrow strip, and I knew, without any telling, that that strip represented the column that contained my pleasant financial satire. From the way he was excitedly mumbling, I saw that the heedless son of a haymow was skipping with all his might, in order to get to the bloody details as quickly as possible. And so he was missing the guide boards I had set up to warn him that the whole thing was a fraud. Presently his eyes spread wide open, just as his jaws swung asunder to take in a potato approaching it on a fork. The potato halted, the face lit up redly, and the whole man was on fire with excitement. Then he broke into a disjointed checking off of the particulars, his potato cooling in mid-air meantime, and his mouth making a reach for it occasionally, but always bringing up suddenly against a new, and still more direful performance of my hero. At last he looked his stunned and rigid comrade impressively in the face, and said, with an expression of concentrated awe, "Jim, he built his baby, and he took the old omen's scalp. Cuss it if I want any breakfast." And he laid his lingering potato reverently down, and his friend departed from the restaurant empty but satisfied. He never got down to where the satire part of it began. Nobody ever did. They found the thrilling particulars sufficient. To drop in with a poor little moral at the fag end of such a gorgeous massacre was like following the expiring sun with a candle and hope to attract the world's attention to it. The idea that anybody could ever take my massacre for a genuine occurrence never once suggested itself to me, hedged about as it was by all those telltale absurdities and impossibilities concerning the Reed Pine Forest, the Rest Stone Mansion, etc. But I found out then, and never have forgotten since, that we never read the dull explanatory surroundings of marvelously exciting things, when we have no occasion, to suppose that some irresponsible scribbler is trying to defraud us. We skip all that, and hasten to revel in the blood-curdling particulars and be happy. The undertaker's chat, now that corpse, said the undertaker, patting the folded hands of deceased approvingly, was a brick every way you took him, he was a brick. He was so real accommodating, and so modest-like and simple in his last moments. Friends wanted metallic burial case, nothing else would do. I couldn't get it. There weren't going to be time anybody could see that. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.